So if you open up Mikraos Gedolos to the end of Perek Zion, the beginning of Perek Ches, and you look at the commentary of the Ralbag, so you'll find something very very funny as you end Perek Zion, which is all of a sudden the Ralbag like stops commenting on the psukim themselves, and the Ralbag, you turn like 20 pages. Keep going. Ralbag is going on and on and on and on. And then 20 pages later, like where the Makros Gedolos is up to, it's already Perek Yud of Shmuel Aleph. And then like the Ralbag starts to catch up with his commentary to Perek Zion. So what is going on? Why does the Ralbag spend so much time there? So it's something that the Ralbag does in his commentary is after a big chunk, he'll say, okay, this is like a unit of Tanakh. And now let's break down all of the lessons that the Navi is trying to teach us, you know, in this unit. So Ralbag viewed the first seven prakim of Shmuel Aleph as the first major unit of the Navi. Right? Chana, Eli, the sons of Eli, the Aron, and then Perek Zion, which was the Perek of Shmuel's leadership. The Ralbag thinks that that is one unit. So he says, we got to take a time out. I'm going to sit here and write for 20 pages about all the things that he learns from those seven prakim. And then we can continue, right? And the reason is because Perek Ches, which we're going to begin this afternoon, and then Rosh Hashem will finish it next week. But the stuff we're going to learn today is we're going to keep on coming back to again and again over the course of the rest of the Sefer, because now we're at the point where Sefer Shmuel takes a real turning point, right? Because now we have to grapple with the question of monarchy and politics, which is a massive theme in Sefer Shmuel, but we have not really discussed until now. You know, it's so interesting when you think about it. Shmuel, we think of Shaul, David, kings, politics, rule, and the first seven prakim have almost nothing to do, right? It's all spiritual messaging and Chana and Eli and Tefillah and Mishkan, Kohen Gadol, Shmuel, the Navi, right? It's like we need our seven prakim of spiritual foundation, which is going to provide the perspective for dealing with like the messy politics that are going to be the focus of the rest of the Sefer. So, you know, we have the foundation from Chana and from Shmuel, and the core message, which we're going to come back to, right, of Hashem Tzavakos, which is for all we're going to wonder, how should we be ruled, the king, what kind of king, what kind of leadership, what tribe should the king be, how should he behave, right? At the end of the day, so such a key point is going to be remembering that Hashem is the Melech Malchei Hamlachim, right? And to a degree, this is like a much ado about nothing, because, you know, the real question, this is what Shmuel's message is going to be, the real question is going to be not how B'nai Yisrael are governed, right, but how they react to the fact that ultimately they're governed by the Ribbono Shel Olam. So that's the foundation, the whole background to what's going to happen here. But that being said, let's dive in, right? And this is so much fun. This is now really gonna, you know, shifting things to a whole new gear. So, right, we said last week we saw Perek Zion, which was that amazing Perek, right? We had all the difficulty and challenge, and finally, you know, it's like, you know, it's like the one sunny day, you know. So we had that one moment where Shmuel is in charge. You know, the people are doing tshuva, they're beating the plishtim, everyone's following Hashem, everything was going great, right? Finally, we got out of the rock bottom, we got out of the rut of the end of Sefer Shoftim, and then the beginning of Sefer Shmuel, right? And we saw Shmuel as just being portrayed as the ideal leader. You want someone with the characteristics of Moshe Rabbeinu, Shmuel has it. Someone has the characteristics of Aaron HaKohen, right? He's Moshe and Aaron rolled into one, and we're just crushing it. Everything was awesome, right? So I got one parak that was like that, good and clean and nice and happy, and we all felt good, you know. And now it's like, you know, like crashing back into, you know, most of the messy reality of Jewish history with parak class. So the Navi tells us at the beginning, "Vayhi kasher zakin Shmuel vayasem es banav shoftim liYisrael." So Shmuel is getting a little bit older, and he puts his two sons. He installs his two sons as judges. You know, just read the first six psukim, and then we'll deal with a couple of issues. So Shmuel's old. How old is he? Put a pin in that. We'll come back to it. Shmuel puts his sons in as judges. Vayishem b'no habachor Yoel v'shem mishnehu Aviyah. For some reason, Navi thinks we have to know the names of his two sons. They're Yoel and Aviyah, right? Yoel meaning, you know, that Hashem is God, and the other one meaning Hashem, right? Hashem is my father. So not surprising, the names that Shmuel chooses for his children, names that reference Hashem, fine. Shoftim b'Be'er Sheva. They're judging in Be'er Sheva. That's a little bit surprising because Be'er Sheva is at the southern tip of the country, right? So Mepharshim are trying to figure out why are Yoel and Aviyah in Be'er Sheva. One suggestion that Ralbag makes, which makes a lot of sense, is Shmuel is judging up in the north in Ramah, where he's from. So as we're going to see, Shmuel, as he gets older, is no longer able to travel the width and breadth of the country as he had before. So we'll have Shmuel based up in the north, and then his sons he sends to be based down in the south. That's wow. That's how Rabag understands why they're in Be'er Sheva and why we care. Okay, so fine. Shmuel's getting older. His sons are judging. Then we have this very difficult pasuk, which we're going to spend a long chunk on today. The Lo Halchu Banav Bidrachav. Shmuel's sons did not follow in his ways. Vayitu acharei habatza, they were inclined after a prophet, let's say. Vayikhu shochad, and they took bribes. Vayatu mishpat, and they twisted justice. So, you know, that's shocking. You know, and talk about a gap between the beginning of the pasuk and the end. Beginning of the pasuk, hey, his sons didn't follow his ways. You know, but all of a sudden, the end of the pasuk, where what? They're accepting bribes and they're corrupting judgment. So we're gonna come back to this pasuk because that's a shocker. Okay, three more pasukim. The Navi continues. Vayiskabtu kol ziknei Yisrael vayuel Shmuel haramasa. So all of the elders of Israel. They're probably not literally elders in terms of being old. It means, you know, the chief political personalities of Bnei Yisrael, probably the Nesiim of the Shvatim and some of the leading heads of the families. So they all gather together to go to Shmuel, who's still in Ramah. Behold, you've gotten old, you know, frank. Your sons have not followed in your ways. More power than they needed to say it. Ata simulanu melech, give us a king, l'shaftenu kochol hagayim, to judge us like all of the other nations. Right? Here is that critical pasuk. They want a king because Shmuel is old, or do they want a king to be like all the other nations? One sounds like a more positive reason, the other sounds more negative. Shmuel is horrified. Vayiradavar b'nei Shmuel, kasher amu t'na l'namach l'shaftenu. Shmuel thought it was terrible that they said they wanted a king to judge them. Shmuel el Hashem. Shmuel davens to Hashem. Okay, so the two major points we're going to have to explain in this chunk of the Navi are what is going on with Shmuel's sons, right? We'll get that in a couple of minutes. The other one is, you know, what exactly, how old was Shmuel? Talk about that in 1 minute. So just one brief point before we get into these two larger issues. That last line of the Navi over here, that Shmuel davens to Hashem. So the Radak actually has a very important comment, which fits in with some of what we developed about Shmuel last week, right? The picture we've been developing about Shmuel is someone who really is in the mold of Moshe and Aaron. Radak follows through on this because it's not clear why Shmuel is davening to Hashem. You might think it's because Shmuel is davening to Hashem stop the people from having a king, but doesn't, as we'll see from the subsequent psukim, doesn't seem to be what's happening. Radak says the reason why Shmuel davens, he says, Hispalel shetavo alav nivuah be'inyan zeh mayedaber Hashem. He is davening for Hashem to talk to him so that they can figure out what to do in this moment of national crisis, which I think is really interesting because that is also a hallmark of Moshe Rabbeinu's tenure, right? At moments where Moshe is not sure what to do, so he goes into the Ohel Moed and he has a conversation with Hashem, right? Normally, you don't have access to Nevuah, right? Lo b'shamayim hi. Shmuel, says the Radak, along with Moshe, is of the caliber of Nevuah that when there are points in leading the people that he's not sure what to do, he can turn to the Ribbono Shel Olam and they can have a conversation. And that's what Shmuel does right over here. That's how the Radak understands this line that Shmuel is mispalel el Hashem. Okay, so, that's what's going on at the moment. So let's go back. Right, the pasuk began by saying that Shmuel has gotten old. So how old is Shmuel? So there's a very interesting abarbanel. I didn't put it on the sheet because it's very long and we don't really need to see the detail. But abarbanel does some very interesting math. He quotes the Seder Olam Rava, right? The classic Midrashic position. You might be familiar with this. That says that when Shmuel passed away, he was 52 years old. This actually gets picked up halacha lemaisa because we try to understand. I think the Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva trying to figure out how old someone has to be considered old, so that if someone wants to name after them, they shouldn't be worried about the idea of not naming after someone who passed away at a young age. So Rav Moshe says the age is 50, and that comes from over here, because here Shmuel is being described as someone who is a zakein, and the assumption is Shmuel lives for 2 years after this, because the assumption is Shaul rules for 2 years after this. We'll worry about Shaul in a few weeks when we get into Shaul's reign. But the idea that Shmuel died at the age of 52 comes really from some very simple math. You assume that Chana had her initial tefillah when Eli was first anointed as the shofet. The Navi says that Eli was the shofet for 40 years. So you take off Eli's first year, because that's when Chana's pregnant. So you have 39 years of Eli being the shofet. Then a couple of weeks ago, last week really, we saw the Navi said that the Aron was in that place, Kiryas Yarim, when it was brought back from the land of the Plishtim, for 20 years. If you assume that it was there for 20 years from when it came from the land of the Plishtim, until all the way when David is king and they take over Yerushalayim and they bring it into the Aron, into Yerushalayim, you're left with 13 years, because 7 years of David is in Hebron. And so you have a result that Shmuel dies and David becomes king 13 years after the death of Eli. So you add 13 to 39, you get 52. And the result is that Shmuel passes away at the age of 52. And so when he's being described as a zakin over here, the youngest we can make him is 50. Abarbanel does not think that makes sense at all. And he has two main reasons for this. Well, he has three. First of all, interestingly, he says, a theme in Tanakh is the great figures in Tanakh, merit a long life. So he says, for Shmuel to die at 52, he's like, that's pretty close to the age of Kares. So he's bothered by the idea of Shmuel dying at such a young age. Interesting. But he has two more concrete problems. One, he thinks, and I think we thought this also when we read this the other week, that the pshat of the Pesukim is that when the Navi said that the Aron was in that place, Kiryas Ya'arim, for 20 years, it didn't mean a total of 20 years until Shmuel Beis, many prakim from now. It just meant it was there for 20 years until Shmuel gathered the people to battle the Plishtim. So that's going to throw off this entire map, right? Because right now we have at least 20 years between Eli's death and the people are being occupied and dominated by the Plishtim, right? We saw last week the slow process of tshuva, and they begin to follow Hashem, and then Shmuel's like, okay, it's time to get rid of your avodah zarah, right? The evolving tshuva process took a long time, says the Abarbanel. That's what it meant. It took 20 years. So that's one major problem with this piece of math. And then he has a really interesting analysis. Shaul, we know of six children Shaul has. Shaul has three sons who are killed with him on Har HaGilboa. He has two daughters, Merav and Michal. And then he has a son whose name we never find out, but he's called Ishbosheth, who is the king after Shaul dies, and he's a personality at the beginning of Shmuel Beis. So in Shmuel Beis, we find out that this Ishbosheth, who was Shaul's youngest son, was 40 years old when Shaul died. So says the Abarbanel, like, let's just do the math, right? His youngest son was 40 when he died. So how old was Shaul by the time he had his sixth child? He says, presumably he was like 24, right? That should be enough time for him to get married and have six children. 24 years old, it's like a reasonably, you know, energetic pace in terms of, you know, having children. So if that's true, that that he was 24 when Ish-bosheth was born, and then, you know, 40 years later Shaul dies, so when Shaul is killed, he is 64 years old, right? Let's say he's in his mid-60s when he's killed by the Plishtim. Now, writes the Barbanel, it is clear who was older, Shmuel or Shaul. It's clear that Shmuel is significantly older than Shaul, because here in Perek Ches, we are describing Shmuel as a Zakein, and in Perek Tes, we're going to describe Shaul as a Bachur, right? As a, you know, young, energetic man. You know, Bachur can mean, you know, anywhere between his 20s, 30s, maybe 40, says Abarbanel, but he's certainly significantly younger than Shmuel. So if you do the math, and Shaul seems like he had to have been in his 60s to justify having children who are so old when he's killed, so then Shmuel must have been significantly older than that. So Abarbanel over here writes, he thinks that Shmuel lived to a total of 70 or 80 years. Later on in Perek Yud Gimel, when he's going to try to figure out how long Shaul was actually king for, Abarbanel is going to write that he thinks that Shmuel is already in his 60s or 70s, here in Perek Ches, which makes a lot of sense, right? He's older. He can no longer, you know, handle the extremely taxing schedule he kept up, where he spent his whole life traveling the whole country. Exceptionally difficult. Writes a Barbanel in Perek Gimel. He thinks that Shmuel is already in his 60s or 70s here in Perek Ches. And then, depending on how long Shaul is king for, right? Shmuel continues to live a while after that. So you have two very different perspectives in terms of how old Shmuel actually is, but just very interesting of Barbanel's, you know, collection of different psukim and some of the math that he does to try to demonstrate that he really thinks that Shmuel at this point really is, you know, older than a 52. It's important to know. Okay, so, you know, enough with the more, you know, innocent discussion, you know, not as threatening about Shmuel's age. Now we got to, you know, enough postponing. Let's talk about the complicated question of the sin of Shmuel's children, right? And it's very difficult, right? The first thing and is the severity of the crime. I'm just going to scroll up to get to the pasuk again. Right? The pasuk says, "Lo hochu banav bidracha." They didn't follow his ways. Vayetu achrei abatza. They followed after prophet. Vayichu shocha. Vayatu mishpat. They took bribes and they perverted justice. So right away, we think of the parallel to the sons of Eli, right? Who were also installed by their father in positions of leadership and abused it for, you know, personal gain, right? We'll see the degree to which Chazal, actually some of the views in Chazal, really run with this parallel. On the one hand, this shows the severity of, right, what's being described, right? Because we did not let up on how bad B'nai Eli were. On the other hand, it makes it even more shocking to read the psukim literally, because from the minute we were introduced to Chana, right, Chana and Shmuel were consistently set up as the polar opposite of Eli and his children. Remember in Perek Beis, when Shmuel is first growing up and the Navi keeps on, you know, shifting the scene, right? Look at young Shmuel, he's great. Look at the sons of Eli, they're terrible. Look at Shmuel, he's great. Look at the sons of Eli, they're terrible. Now all of a sudden, really, we're saying that Shmuel's sons are just like the sons of Eli. And by the way, Shmuel is behaving like Eli himself, because we never see Shmuel protest his children's behavior, right? Which makes it even more difficult to read the psukim literally. Right, and compound it. I'm just going to scroll down to a couple of the reasons which militate against reading the pasuk, you know, literally, and then we'll see what some of the mafarshim and gemaras do. You know, so just a couple of the quick hits. Perek Yud Beis, when Shmuel has his farewell address. So what does he tell them? He says, I'm old. Uvanai, he says, my kids are with you. So is it really true, right? Shmuel is being told. Let's say Shmuel was unaware of what was going on in Parakas. That's what a Barbanel is going to say. It's hard to swallow, but could be. But Parakid Beis, if they're really taking, if they're so corrupt that they're literally taking bribes to throw cases, can Shmuel still tell the people in Parakid Beis, you know, I'm going, but you still, and you have your king, and you still have my sons? Very, very difficult to swallow. It just is.
It just is.
Right? You know, even Eli was not this obtuse, frankly, right? If we're going to read it literally. Furthermore, look in Divrei Hayamim, right? And we discover that that Shmuel's grandson, right? Yoel was Shmuel's oldest son. The Navi made sure to tell us his sons were Yoel and Aviyah. So, Heman HaMishorer ben Yoel ben Shmuel. So, right, the son of Yoel seems like the head of the singers in the Beis HaMikdash. Why is that significant? Well, if we're comparing the sons of Eli to the sons of Shmuel, right, which Navi clearly seems to do in terms of the sin, the outcome could not be more different. Because what was the outcome? What was the result with the sin of Eli and his children? First of all, right, the Navi comes and warns Eli. And then Hashem gives a nevuah to Shmuel. And we saw those were moments where they were supposed to be tshuva and they didn't do it. What's the punishment? Total destruction, devastation, right? They are permanently banished from serving as Kohanim in the Beis HaMikdash, right? Total, they're killed, they're banished. It's the end of the line for Eli and his sons. So what do we have here with Shmuel Ubanav? Perek Yabez, Shmuel is still telling the people, you know, my sons are around. It sounds like his sons are still in a prominent leadership position. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense for Shmuel to say, have my sons. It sounds like they're still in prominent positions of leadership. And far from being banished, Shmuel's grandson is the head singer in the Beis HaMikdash, right? When Shlomo takes over, so he completes the process of eliminating the house of Eli. He fires Abiasar, the Kohen Gadol, the descendant of Eli, and the Pasuk in Melachim says, that's it. When Shlomo banished Abiatar, that fulfilled Shmuel's original prophecy, banishing the descendants of Eli from the Beis HaMikdash. And at the same time, this Haman, Shmuel's grandson, the son of Yoel, is being installed as the head singer, right? Like, you know, that's the choicest job for the Levium in the Beis HaMikdash. So that outcome is the polar opposite. You never have a complaint from Hashem. Shmuel's behavior, you know, just doesn't seem to make any sense. You put all these things together and you just have to wonder, right? Is it really possible to read the Pesukim literally? If you will, you're going to have significant problems. But if not, you're going to have to explain what's going on. So we'll look at what some of the Mefarshim do, and then we'll look at what some of the, you know, major points in Chazal, the Gemara and the Talmud Yerushalmi do. We're not, you know, just to put it on the table now, we're not going to come away with one clear, easy read of the Pesukim, but I think we will come away with, you know, a very clear, a very helpful lesson going forward, which we'll discuss when we get there. So first, you know, we got to start with Rashi. We always start with Rashi. So Rashi first just tells you how to read the words, because the words of the pasuk were a little bit challenging, because the same word is used twice, vayitu, vayatu. So Rashi says, you know, here's the translation of the pasuk. They bent themselves for profit, and then they twisted mishpat. You know, the same word is used. Rashi is just pointing out to you that the word means sort of two different things, right? They're twisting themselves for profit, and then they're twisting the judgment. Bissinger. Then Rashi quotes the Gemara. He says, Rabba Seinu Amru, Lo Chatu B'nei Shmuel. Right? This may sound a little familiar, because this is famous or infamous in some circles. We'll get to this in a little bit. Right? They didn't sin. Lo Halchu B'darche Avien. They just did not follow in their father's way. Shmuel had such immense self-sacrifice that he would travel the whole country to judge the people. They didn't do that. They just stayed at home. They stayed in Be'er Sheva. And that's being compared to bribery. Why? Because they wanted to have their friends, right, their scribes, the stationary court that they set up. It was a lucrative operation. People come. You have to pay fees to the judge, pay to the scribe, fees to the scribes, fees to the officers. It was more lucrative to have the Beis Din be at home than for them to just go on the donkey and travel around. Rashi quotes the Gemara. Right? We'll come back to this view, the view that the sons of Shmuel did not sin, but they're being criticized because they're staying home and they're, in the interest of pursuing profit. Let's put it this way, before we look at a Barbanel and a Ralbag, if we recall when Rashi was commenting on the sons of Eli, right, that very bizarre pasuk that said out of nowhere that not only were they stealing all the meat from the Karbanos, but they were also sleeping with the women in the Mishkan. So Rashi gave the Gemara's interpretation of that as well. It's the same Tana says that over there too. But before Rashi did that, Rashi made sure to tell you, Kim Mashma'o, right? First Rashi said, read the pasuk literally. And then he says, I'll tell you the drash, right? So he says, read it literally, but I'll tell you the other way to read the pasuk, right? Here, Rashi never tells you, read it kimashma'o, right? He translates the words because the words are difficult, but he never tells you, read the pasuk literally. It sounds like Rashi thought there was a difference between what's going on with B'nai Eli and what's going on with B'nai Shmuel. And he is more inclined to read what the Gemara is going to say, explaining the sons of Shmuel as pshat, as opposed to what happened with the sons of Eli, where Rashi thought that you should know that view is there, but do not think that view is the pshat of the pasuk. That is what Rashi has to say. On the other extreme, you have a Barbanel and Ralbag. Right, it's going to be a theme in Sefer Shmuel because this is really going to be helpful going forward, because when you think of Sefer Shmuel, so the shadow that looms over everything we have these conversations, of course, is the very next piece in the Gemara over there, understanding the sin of David and Bathsheba, right? So it's almost like we're given a trial run here in Parak Ches, the more, not as difficult, still challenging, but not as challenging, frankly, case of the sons of Shmuel. And figuring out the methodology for this one, is helpful as a tool. You need to have the ability to approach Perek Ches of Shmuel Aleph in order to be able to get ready for David and Bathsheba, in Shmuel Beis. We're going to see that a couple more times when we get into David's career. The tools are placed there for understanding how to approach that, most difficult part of the whole Sefer. Anyway, Abarbanel. So Abarbanel quotes the Gemara, right, that the sons of Shmuel didn't take bribes, just, that they didn't travel. Okay, fine. Says the Abarbanel, Aval pshat haksuvim yo'ir al chatam. So what can I say? I read the text, the pasuk says that they sinned. And it sounds like Abarbanel thinks that they sinned with real bribery. He says, V'gam k'tzas chachminu zal hoduba. Says also, some of Chazal agreed to this. Now, I don't really understand this line, because we'll see when we get to the Gemara. Actually, most of the views in the Gemara think that the sons of Shmuel sinned, and with some pretty bad stuff. But none of the views in Chazal think that what they did was actually bribery. So that's on both points, I don't really understand this line, because it's not Ktsas Chachmenu, it's Rov Chachmenu, as we'll see in the Gemara, think that the sons of Shmuel really sinned. But none of them, nobody thinks that it was real bribery. The reason why is very clear. Abarbanel says, I'm going to ask some questions, which I haven't seen anyone ask, right? He says, why didn't Hashem ever give Musar to Shmuel like he did to Eli? And why weren't the sons of Shmuel punished like the sons of Eli were punished, right? Abarbanel gets himself into a pickle because he reads the pasuk completely literally, which means that you're reading the sons of Shmuel as the exact same, basically, as the sons of Eli. But then he says, well, I have to explain why the results are so different. And he says, the Mefarshim were not bothered by this at all. That's kind of funny. The reason the Mefarshim weren't bothered by this at all was because Abarbanel is an outlier in terms of the degree to which he's willing to read the Pesukim literally, right? But so that's where he gets himself. We'll look at his answers and let's evaluate them. So he says, I think there are two reasons why the outcome for Eli and his sons was so different from the outcome for Shmuel. He says, number one, let me think about this. Number one, the sin of Eli's sons was famous and widespread. Everyone knew what was going on in Shiva. He says the sin of the sons of Shmuel was nistar, was hidden, because bribery is not done out in the open. So one was an open sin, one was a hidden sin. Okay, let's turn over a second. Any thoughts, any responses to that perspective? Things feel better? I'll say what I think. Number one, you know, it clearly isn't completely secret, because it's well known enough that everyone's coming to Shmuel saying your kids are not doing the job, so give us a king, right? So it's clearly not like, you know, nobody knows about this. Number two, is that alone enough to justify the discrepancy in the reaction? Because it's in private versus in public? Is the gap between permanent banishment and death of all your family at a young age versus basically no long-term consequences whatsoever? Doesn't really seem to do it. So Abarbanel is probably aware of that. So Abarbanel gives a second proposal. And Abarbanel says, hey, the severity of the sin was different. Says the sons of Eli, right? I think this is especially, you know, according to his view, the sons of Eli, they're committing adultery. The sons of Eli, they are taking meat, which is supposed to be burnt on the Mizbeach. So he says, they're engaged in capital crimes, right? He says, bribery? Yeah, is bribery. How severe is the crime of bribery? It's not, there's no chi of misa for bribery. He says, they took lo chatu ki im belakicha shochat. What a line. Oh, the only sin they had was taking bribes. Chain adam chayav alav misa. There's no capital punishment for bribery. So he says, that's why their punishment was just that they lost the opportunity to lead the people, right? And he says Shmuel didn't know about it, so Shmuel wasn't blamed, right? I don't know. Eli was told about it. Eli seemed to be sticking his head in the sand. Shmuel, so we get from Barbanel, is the sons are sinning, but it's in secret, not so compelling, frankly. And it's you know, all they're doing is taking bribes. Now that's like quite a mouthful. All they're doing is taking bribes. We'll revisit that in 1 second. Just someone else, you know, Ralbag, who is like the Abarbanel, but is not willing to go so far, because it's just, you know, look at the pickle Abarbanel gets himself into. So Ralbag proposes it wasn't bribery; it's what we call corruption. You know, they took gifts from people, you know, and then they judged them. So, you know, they imagined we can maintain our objectivity. I can be friends with someone. He wants to give me a couple cigars, the Seder Gomer, I'll still be objective when I judge his case. It wasn't bribery. It didn't meet the ethics standards, writes the Ralbag. He says, doesn't matter. A judge cannot take presents from someone, right? Ki ha-shochad yavreini chachamim. He says, you can't take shochad, even though you don't intend to twist the judgment. That's how the Ralbag, right? Much more moderate than Abarbanel. Fits with the pshat of the psukim, right? But, you know, there was corruption, not bribery. Still deeply inappropriate, still really surprising, but, you know, not doesn't raise as much of as severe a question. Now, just we should get on the record, Abarbanel's line that they only sinned with the taking of bribery. I mean, my gosh, just, you know, two quick sources, right? The pasuk in Yeshayahu, Hashem says, Ki ani Hashem ohev mishpat sone geza. I mean, Hashem says to you in Sefer Yeshayahu, right? That God despises theft, Ola, right? And this is being compared to Mishpat. So, you know, it might be technically, it's not a chi of Misa, right? But you know, it's despised. Gemara Sanhedrin, where Rish Lakish says, and this could be a whole shiur, but for now, we'll just take Rish Lakish and one come from the Marsha. Rish Lakish says, Kol ha-mamid dayan she'ino hagun. If you set up a judge who is not worthy, ki'ilu noteya asherah b'Yisrael. It is the equivalent of setting up an idolatrous tree in the middle of Israel. Shnemar shoftim shotrim titan lacha. Right, first pasuk in Parsha Shoftim says, set up judges. And right afterwards, Torah says, v'samachlei, afterwards we're told, lo sita lacha asherah. Don't set up an avodah zarah tree. Marsha comments on the Gemara, says the Marsha, the reason behind this is because the judge, right? The judge is a fountain of Torah. The judge is even compared to Hashem. right? Judges in the Chumash are called Elohim. The same term for a judge is used for Hashem. So if you set up a false judge who is issuing false rulings, that is tantamount to Avodah Zarah. It says good judgment, right? Someone who's judging honestly, he is a partner with Hashem, right? He's actualizing Torah in the world. False judge, corrupt judge, is the exact opposite. That's Avodah Zarah. So, you know, Barbanel can write, bribery is not so bad, but, you know, maybe technically you don't have a chiv misa, but for the punishment to be so light for a crime that's so severe is very, very difficult. So you're forced to balance, right? If you go in one extreme of mitigating the sin, at the end of the day, you have to deal with what the pasuk said. On the other hand, if you go with the extreme of reading it completely literally, then you just get into a train wreck, right, of and kind of coming up with answers for the consequences, which just don't seem to be enough. Okay, so that's you know, like the two poles, and you see Rabag is trying to moderate. Just scroll down for a second. We'll look at the passage in the Gemara, because it is absolutely fascinating, some of the views, right? This is, you know, it's the famous or infamous Gemara, Shabbos Nun Hey Amid Beis Nun Vav Amid Aleph, right, which deals with a list of prominent sinners in Tanakh and, you know, explains what's going on. Reuven, the sons of Eli, the sons of Shmuel, David, and Shlomo, right? And, you know, what's very important, what people don't realize, as you know, this is thought of as the whitewashing Gemara. But every single one, there are other views and even majority views which do not whitewash the sin, say they sinned, and let's actually see what they say. But we can understand the motivation for this, right? Which is, if you read the pasuk literally, it's just very, very hard to justify. So Gemara says, Amr b'Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amr b'Yonasan. And he's the one who's saying all these. Kol ha'omer b'nei Shmuel chatu enu elata. Someone who says that the sons of Shmuel sinned is just mistaken. Shneamar, right? So the Navi said, "Vahik yizaken Shmuel v'nav lo alchu b'drachav." Right? They did not follow in his ways. If you remember, we flagged the fact that there are two different, you know, connotations from the pasuk. The beginning of the pasuk, and they didn't follow in his ways. End of the pasuk, they're taking bribes. That's like, you know, so Rabbi Yonasan emphasizes the first half of the pasuk. He says, "B'drachav hu d'lo halchu." They didn't follow his ways, but they weren't actually sinning. And let's recall, by the way, when the people come to Shmuel to complain, they do not tell Shmuel, your sons are taking bribes. They tell Shmuel, your sons are not following in your ways. So, okay. He says, Alamani makayim v'yatu achrei habatza. What does the second half of the pasuk mean? That they're going after money? So he says, just like Rashi said, that's where Rashi gets it from. They did not keep up to their father's standard, who was, right, Shmuel HaTzadik, would travel the width and breadth of the country, and they did not do this in order to procure more profit. Okay. Meiri has a very important comment on this, right, which is, you know, look, if this is the case, if all they're doing is not the unbelievable honesty and integrity and dedication of being a judge on the road your whole life, so if it's just more normal behavior, frankly, because we don't really see judges other than Shmuel doing this, why are they so severely criticized? So the Meiri just writes, he says, you know, normally when we talk about to what extent we expect somebody to be an outstanding spiritual representative or just average. Normally, we expect the Mida Beinonis, right? The golden mean, you know, someone has to balance. He has to balance his work and his life. He has to balance being at home with his kids and everything, with, you know, being a judge and being honest and fair. But writes the Meiri, when you are stepping into your father's footsteps and your father established a famous precedent that he was outstanding and remarkable and one of a kind in how he served as a judge, and now you are coming into your father's footsteps, so that sets the bar much higher than it otherwise would be. Very important, right, idea that the Meiri takes out of this Gemara. We can't just judge someone's conduct in a vacuum, right? You know, standard has been set by their predecessor, especially when it was their father. Now, the Gemara then continues, right? And this is where, you know, really get the good stuff. The Gemara says, this view of Rabbi Yonasan, Ketanai. This matches up with the following Tanaitic source, right? Here's the Braisa. four views in the Tanaim what exactly the sons of Shmuel did, and some of them are really interesting. Vayatu achrei abasa, they followed after prophet. Meir Omer, chalkam sha'alu b'fihem. What does that mean? Explains Rashi. So remember, these are Leviim. Shmuel is a Levi. He's a descendant of Korach. So they are entitled to Maser Rishon. So explains Rashi, what's happening is they would go and ask people to give them the Maser. So what's going to happen, right? Inevitably, everyone's going to give their Maser to the sons of Shmuel. And what happens, writes Rashi, the rest of the Leviim are stuck, right? They're going to go hungry because everyone's giving, you know, it's like Mishloach Manos, right? Everyone gives to the most popular, you know, family in town, and no one's given to the people who don't have any friends, right? So that's what Rashi says is going on. And Rashi highlights, according to Rabbi Meir, lo chatu b'hatayas mishpat. According to Rabbi Meir, they did not sin at all in the world of judgment. Okay, now, what does that mean going forward? If Rashi has to tell us, according to Rabbi Meir, their sin had nothing to do with corruption in court. Well, Rashi's telling you that because he's well aware everyone else in the Brisa thinks indeed they did sin, and the sin did have outcomes on Mishpah, right? Maybe not literally, as Abarbanel says, bribery, but there's stuff going on here. What do we have in the rest of the Brisa? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Mili Hitilu Al Balai Batim. Explains Rashi, they invested money with people, right? And when you invest money with people who are then going to come to you, you know, for court decisions, so, you know, you can imagine that they will be incentivized to make sure that your investment was a profit, right? So that's the view of Rabbi Yehuda. And then two more. Here's the ones that are really cool. Rabbi Akiva Omer, Kupa Yesera Shal Meiser Natlu. They took more Meiser than they were supposed to receive. Unclear whether this means that they took more than 10%, which is theft, or they mean, but let's just say that's the pshat, right? They took more than 10%, let's say. You know, Rav Moshe Feinstein reads it a little bit differently, that like he thinks that the farmers would have packages of maser for people, and it was supposed to be like one package per person, and the people would take more. But either way, says they forcibly took more mice than they should. And Rabbi Yossi says they took gifts, bizra, forcibly, right? Now, what does it mean, gifts? So Rashi has a comment, which is going to give away the game. Rashi says they took zrawa lechayim v'keva. They took the parts of the cow, the parts of the animal, which are supposed to be given as gifts to the kohen. V'heim lo hayu kohanim. And they were not kohanim. They're levim taking gifts which are meant for kohanim. So what is this? Where's Rabbi Yossi getting this from? He's picking up, and Rabbi Akiva is doing this as well, they're picking up on the comparison in the Navi between the sons of Shmuel and the sons of Eli. And just like the sons of Eli were taking the food that was not supposed to be given to them, right? Because it belonged to either the owner of the carbon or to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Well, so the sons of Shmuel do the same thing. They're taking more maser than they deserve, parallel to the sons of Eli taking more meat than the owner had to give them. And Rabbi Yossi says they're taking stuff that doesn't belong to them, right? That belongs to the Kohen. Here, the sons of Shmuel, right? The sons of Eli took stuff before the blood was sprinkled. They're cheating Hashem. And now the Levim are cheating the Kohanim. So far from whitewashing the conduct of the sons of Shmuel, right? The Gemara is trying, and you see the different views in the Gemara, right? We're trying to put what they did in context. We're also not denying that there's clearly sinful behavior here. And there are views which are following up on the connection that the Navi draws between the sons of Eli and the sons of Shmuel. And this last one, Rabbi Yossi, even draws an extremely strong connection. Now, Rashi is not 100% sure if these were the gifts for Kohanim or not. But either way, right, you know, it's not why Rashi. So just I put a list here down at the bottom, and you know the views in the Yerushalmi as well, right? So from the more minimalistic perspectives, they didn't travel, right, or they just used their position to get more meiser. They used the Rionis and Rei Meir, right, to ones which are there's more financial chicanery over here, right? They're investing money with people, they're stealing, right? They're taking more meiser than they should. They're taking stuff that was supposed to be given to the Kohanim, okay. The Yerushalmi has a couple of other views. One was that they would take Maaser from people and then judge their case. So that's, again, that's not bribery, but that's corruption, right? You give me Maaser, which I'm entitled to because I'm a Levi, and then I'll judge your case. You know, there's no crime here. It's not on the books, but that's just not ethical, right? That's a lot more than just Rabbi Yonason's description that they didn't travel. One other view in the Yerushalmi, Rabbi Brachia, who says that they spent their time and energy making money instead of in the courtroom. You know, they were more passionate about their commerce career than about their judicial career. But again, not literal bribery. So either way, right? Bottom line is that there's a consensus, like the Rabbanel said, frankly, that there is sinful behavior here, and it might be pretty severe, right? Same time, other views mitigating it, right? And almost nobody who reads literally. So, you know, when we think about like what to take away from this, because we don't have any clear resolution for what was happening with the sons of Shmuel, right? We're just at some point we're stuck with tension, you know, and it seems clear that the Navi is not clearly telling us what happened. So I think that there's one point that we really can't take away from this, which is, right, this next week we'll talk about the question of and the problem of kingship, right? But anyway, what's the real problem we have with kings, or one real problem? Well, it's very clear in Sefer Shmuel is that even if one king is good, right, the next one might be a disaster. Because that's the theme in Shmuel, is that the dynasty principle doesn't seem to work. Eli, not so bad. His sons, terrible. Shmuel, great, amazing. His sons, not amazing, right? David is going to have son after son, Amnon and Avshalom and Adoniyahu, right? Who one disaster after another. So you can, you know, setting up a kingdom is not going to be a panacea for you, because the, you know, having a dynasty, oh, the next leader is not going to be so great. But what's the alternative, right? Is the alternative, you know, well, we'll just pick the best leader for each generation. Well, Moshe Rabbeinu was able to do that. Moshe Rabbeinu was able to install Yoshua. But Shmuel has a pattern, right? We see it here where he wants his sons to be in charge. Doesn't work. Shmuel is going to favor Shaul over David. Not going to work. Shmuel is going to favor David's brothers over David. Again, not going to work. So Shmuel, right, the greatest of the great, the one who's compared to Moshe and Aaron, the one area in which he does fall short of Moshe, he's not able to be able to pick who the next leader should be. And if Shmuel can't identify who the next leader should be, well, then who has any hope of being able to reliably predict it, right? It's like in the NBA where they spend millions of dollars trying to figure out who to draft. But yeah, you can't figure out who some 17-year-old kid, if he's going to be Michael Jordan or if he's going to be, you know, someone who, Kwame Brown, someone you never heard of Kwame Brown. But so Mimana Shah, either way, you want the dynasty, you can't predict if it's going to work, right? You want to choose who's going to rule. Shmuel can't figure that out either, right? So I think one clear takeaway, there is no political solution to your problems. And the Navi seems to be going out of its way to emphasize the severity of what the sons of Shmuel did, right? Whatever they did, the only consensus view seems like may have been bad, wasn't as bad as the Navi makes it out to be. But what the Navi wants you to come away from this from is that in the Perek, which is going to most heavily bring home the problems with a king, do not think that the alternative is clearly any better, right? Because you want Shmuel to decide who's gonna rule. Shmuel's going to choose his children or someone else, and that might not solve your problems either. The bottom line is going to be you can't rely on political solutions, one way of choosing a leader to solve all of your problems. And while Shmuel's sons may not have been as bad as the Pasuk, you know, gives you the implication that they were, we want you to think that this was a dead-end path as well, right? That should not be any doubt. So we then come out of the first half of the parak, right? Like, you know, between a rock and a hard place, the current trajectory we're on of Shmuel deciding who should take over, that's not going to work. And so the next week, we'll look, you know, we'll turn to the question of Malthus. The people want their king. And then we'll see, you know, why Shmuel is so upset. Is Hashem so upset? and you know what are the different views going to be about that. So you know, this is like we're really in the real meat of it now. And you know, anybody has any thoughts, love to hear, because definitely it's controversial stuff. But otherwise, looking forward to next week.
I just wanted to comment. I find it curious that Shmuel doesn't address the issue with the sons at all. The way Eli's response to his kids was weak, granted, but Shmuel doesn't say anything to his children. And you think with him having set the bar so high that we have better expectations for his sons.
Which is one of the factors which militates against reading the pasuk so literally, because even when the people tell Shmuel, your children are not behaving like you did, Shmuel comes back in Parak Yud Beis and he says, you know, hey, look, you know, you have my sons. Like if we could imagine for sure, if the Navi had told Eli, you know, your sons are not going to take over, Shmuel is going to take over instead. And then there was a pasuk where Eli, on his way out the door, says, you know, you have Shmuel, but you also have Chafni and Pinchas, right? So we would have read that, and we would have just, you know, we wouldn't know if we should laugh or cry. But that's exactly what happens with Shmuel. So I think that you know, either it's like the most severe criticism you can imagine, or you know, it tells you that we need to read this with, you know, more under the surface than the initial passage gives us, 100%. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone for coming.
Thank you.